Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
Hey, and a good morning to you. I hope you're doing well. We have some rain here in California, here in Northern California. And as you know, and I've said it many, many times, we are dealing with a drought. So I'm happy. I'm very, very happy. It's very precarious to be driving right now because we've had some drenching rain. We've had like 2 or 3 inches in the last 24 hours, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when it's coming down at nighttime, it's kind of hairy driving the car. So I got to go out today, so it's going to be interesting. I hope you're doing well. Hope everything's good. Hey, I posted a very interesting article. As you know, we've been talking about the pyramids, megaliths in the last few weeks, and a figure who's come up just here and there is the former Secretary General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, the man known as Dr. Zahi Hawass. And for those of you who are not familiar with him, he, for many years, oversaw the excavations of the Giza Plateau, the pyramids, the Sphinx, and some of the other structures in the area. And although appeared to be quite open and honest about his work on the plateau, was very obstructive for a lot of researchers. We don't need to name their names right now, but I posted a fascinating article written by the late Philip Copens on our Facebook page called The Egyptologist, the Sphinx, and the Cover-Up. And this is a fascinating article. It's a long article, but it goes into the issues around Hawass's denial of good research. And many people, including Graham Hancock, Chris Dunn, and specifically Robert Bavall, feel that he has covered up some significant discoveries on the plateau, things like canals, and probably the mechanics behind the operation of the Sphinx. Now, no one's allowed to go under the Sphinx. No one's allowed to actually pass through many, many of these passages. But this article details really what kind of a gentleman this person is. And I shouldn't even use the word gentleman. He has he's really put the lid on some fascinating possibilities and discoveries. And you can read this article, The Egyptologist, the Sphinx, and the Cover-Up, on our Facebook page. Go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, and go to group. I actually posted it on the international page, too, so check it out. It's quite fascinating. Also, we'll give you an idea about just what kind of problems we face when we have somebody like that in office. A few weeks ago, we did a raffle for that Graham Hancock book, Magicians of the Gods, and had a very, very big participation for it. We're going to do that again. I'm going to do it right now. Here's what we want to do. If you would like to be in the raffle, send me an email. Send it to Cliff at earthancients.com. Pick a number between 1 and 600 and email it to me with your address. And on March 26, we will raffle off another copy of that book, Magicians of the Gods. I'll mention this again later in the show after our guest is on. But if you want to get a copy, I got another copy from the publisher. Go ahead and send me your name, email, and a number between, pick a number between 1 and 600. And you could get a copy of that amazing book. So do that if you can. We have with us from the History Channel, Hutton Pulitzer. And Hutton is going to give us an update on what's been going on with the Oak Island discovery. This has been a fascinating turn of events. And it seems like every week there's something new to report. We haven't had Hutton on in a while. And I do want to talk with him a little bit. Hutton, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Great, great. Tell us what's going on with the Oak Island situation. What's been the latest?
Well, the most important thing is we are now ready to release the Oak Island Sword Report. That's where we do the high-tech analytics of the sword and compare it to what History Channel actually allowed to be released on the air. It's a pretty shocking report. It's pretty sobering. Kind of tells you how history is hidden many times by just playing with the words or playing with the test. It ended up being about a 200-page report. We're just working out some final bugs because there's 20 video pieces incorporated into it, 20 audio pieces incorporated into it. But think of it as a course on how to read through the muck and deception in archaeology and anthropology sometimes. But that should be ready for everybody to start receiving on Wednesday. Now, just we put out some preliminary samples of it to some of our followers to say, hey, are we on the right track? Is this the way to help educate people? What do you think about it? And we got such a phenomenal response from key members of our fan base that we've decided to release a second one, which is in the works right now. What this one is going to be is we are going to release a survey of Oak Island. Now, as you know, Oak Island has been unsolved for now about 222 years, it's about to turn. But what's important is it's only 140 acres. What we're going to do is we're going to take that 140 acres, which is less than 75 yards from the mainland, and we're going to pull back the timeline of water 2,000 years, and we're going to show you a survey of what Oak Island really looked like, plus we're going to release where the ancient standing stones were on the island. They all got pulled over, blown up. And what you're going to see for the first time is you're going to see some amazing ancient geometry that's astrologically aligned on the island. And we're going to show you not only those, but where these ancient burial mounds are. We think this is going to help blow the lid off the real history of Oak Island and, of course, Nova Scotia. And if you thought the Sword Report was controversial, well, wait till it hits the fan with this one, because there's no denying the physical artifacts that are there. And if we just pull back the water, we just suspend the timeline, forget what you know about Oak Island, forget what you know about North American history, throw Columbus out the door, and then watch what happens if we just look at it with the perfect time measurement system. And what is that? Well, we know exactly how much the water increases each year since the last ice age. So watch it when we pull back 2,000 years of water. You are going to be amazed, and it's going to give you a new picture of what Oak Island really is, and more importantly, show you how important Oak Island is to the history of the Americas.
So did you do a lidar scan of the island and kind of uncover some of these standing stones, or are these what you have in reports, or do you have evidence of these stones?
Well, we actually have photographic evidence of the stones. One of the first things that happened for us when we went to the island, now remember how we approached it. Although History Channel called my team treasure hunters, we're actually forensic historians. And so we said, we don't care about any of the tips or secrets or hints or what you think this coconut fiber junk is. We just want to see what the island tells us and what the ancients, because their native tribes haven't been moved in 8,000 years. When we got to the island, we started seeing a particular type of stone that wasn't glacial till, meaning it wasn't rounded by being rolled around in the glacial stone. we actually notice these stones, these monolithic stones, are fashioned by men. And when we looked at them and realized they were cut at certain angles or had certain siding devices, but they had been repurposed on the island as building materials, all of a sudden the light went off. Well, where did these stones come from? And there's two different sets of stones. So when we inquired with Canada, look, this particular type of stone is not native to Oak Island, and we asked, where does this type of stone occur? We found out something very interesting. We found out that that particular type of stone occurs 350 feet deep within Oak Island. So you got to ask yourself, how did cut stone that appears 350 feet deep in the island get to the surface? And then when we started looking and inquiring on other stones, and these stones have symbols, and some of these symbols match symbols on the other side of the pond. And we started asking about them through the old timers and old records. We found out that they were, in fact, standing stones. So we were able to locate some of the stones. They've been moved. They've been chained off. And several of them, luckily, have not been blown up to hide them. And what we found out is, well, they're there. They stand up. And you can sight them. And that's what we're going to reveal in those surveys, actual physical evidence combined with the underwater evidence of what we were able to show, and we're going to line them all up from you, and something magically happens when you line them up. Well, they give us a great time and date and match with the solstice for the area, and that's what we're going to release.
Okay, and now is this something that we can post on the website, or is this a flyer, or what's this going to be in terms of a document?
It's an interactive It's an interactive PDF download. So what we'll be able to do is we'll post it on our sites. Our the group on, of course, Facebook, the main group that we run is called Curse of Oak Island Official. That's the facebook.com/groups and then Curse of Oak Island Official. And then for your listeners and readers, what we'll do is we will give you a download. You can post that download. They go to it, they download it, and it's actually interactive. And they can either read it or they can watch it or they can listen to it. And, of course, to save size, we'll record bits and explain what they're looking at. So it's like an interactive tour of how to understand this stuff.
Okay. And so just quickly before we finish here, what is your estimate on the age of Oak Island, its original, perhaps an astronomical feature of some kind?
Well, our age that we released on the History Channel that everybody was reluctant about is we said the event horizon for what we were searching for initially on Oak Island is about anywhere between 560 and 590 BC. Conflicts with us is we can find, you know, we find all kinds of artifacts that say 180 or 280, and then there's artifacts to the BCs. But what's really interesting is there's certain types of stone carvings that that are on Oak Island and around Oak Island, but the only place you find them around the globe that has been dated, they're giving a date much older than 560 to 590 BC. So, but right now we're just saying 560, 590 BC for this part, but, you know, the science may reveal it's even older. I think what's interesting is when you see some of the symbols we're going to release, that not only do they occur in the ancient Levant, but they go all the way up through, you know, Spain, Portugal, France, all the way through the UK, come all the way around, and the same symbols not only appear on Oak Island, but go down the St. Lawrence Seaway down into the Great Lakes. We might have found the debarking point, possibly, for the ancient Bronze Age coming to the Americas.
Wow, fantastic. Well, I look forward to getting that material and we'll make it available to our audience and Facebook people. As soon as you get it to me, that would be great. So thank you for that update. And, boy, you keep turning rocks over and finding some amazing stuff. So that's kind of mind-blowing.
It's kind of hard to hide what's written in stone. And thank God the ancients wrote in stone. Now, some of the guys in Oak Island, they did try to blow up these stones. But thank God for fragments, thank God for other stones that they missed, and thank God for new ones turned over. But it's telling a very, very ancient story.
Hutton Pulitzer, thank you for that update, and I'll look forward to getting that in my audience. So those of you who are listening, we will make sure that you get a copy of this new information. Thank you, Hutton. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
So that's Hutton Pulitzer from the History Channel and Oak Island specific information. Boy, it seems like there's just so much going on there. It's I can't keep up with it. I don't watch enough TV, so I'm glad we had a chance to have him on the program. You know, we've discussed a number of ancient sites. We've talked about megalithic builders. We've talked about the Great Pyramid, and we've had authors on the program who have dissected the mechanics behind places like the Giza Plateau and the Great Pyramid, the Sphinx, the ruins in South America, Peru, Cusco. And I've talked a number of times about the mechanics behind places like Central Mexico, Teotihuacan, and the serpent, feathered serpent pyramid, and the strange mechanics that are going on inside of that pyramid, the discovery of pyrite golden balls and some other mixtures that must have had some kind of a chemical reaction. But these are all the mechanics. These are all the construction techniques. My guest today has taken the discovery of these sacred sites and these what you might consider special, almost holy places of megalithic builders, and has looked at them in a different point of view. And what he's going to tell us today, and by the way, my guest today is Freddie Silva, and the book we're going to talk about is The Divine Blueprint. You know, there are ancient temples, power places, and there are these sacred places that for some reason were built over in many places, ley lines, geomagnetic fields, telluric fields. We've talked a number of times about John Burke's work and testing pyramids and testing these sacred sites. You know, what was the genius behind this? What was the intent behind this? Who was thinking things like this up? And Freddie Silva has done something that I really applaud, and that is looking at these subject matters from a scientific point of view, but reaching even further into the possibilities of what is the mindset of these ancient builders. Freddie, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello, Cliff. How are you doing?
Great. Great to have you on. I really liked your book, and I'm not even, you know, I've kind of scanned it, and I'm really going to dig down and look at it. But what was it about these places? What was it that you discovered and found was almost an intent behind the building of these sacred sites?
It really was a matter of just going to these places, hundreds of them around the world, and slowly beginning to realize that, they start talking back to you, which is the strangest thing to say on air, unless you've experienced it. These places really are alive. They're living, breathing organisms, and they have a profound effect on you. And then just being aware of your environment and starting to connect the dots. And I come from my former environment when I was actually paid for a living to sort of connect dots, and I applied it to this work and found that there is this common element to temple building around the world. So whether you're talking about Native America, the Celtic cultures of Britain or the Egyptians or even the southern Indian cultures, all the temples look very different, but they share certain commonalities such as the use of sacred geometry, the fact that they're all basically built on top of the special spots on the earth, you know, where geomagnetism and electromagnetism combine to create an effect which is very palpable to many people and certainly measurable by today's computers. And realizing that there was a big plan that was etched together by some very unusual people around the globe. And when you start sort of pulling the veil back a bit further, because, I mean, one of the things that I learned when I was at school, very early on when I was 12, I had a great history teacher, and he said, you know, if you want to find the answer to anything, you've really got to go back at least, 50 years before the events to really understand the mechanics of the events itself. And it was great advice, because by going back, 10,000 years into our prehistory, suddenly there's a big picture comes up when you start matching it to mysticism, to ancient scripture, and to legend. And when you start adding these things to geology and archaeology, my God, there's a huge plan that was put here by people of extraordinary minds, and they did it all to basically give us a big jolt when we forgot that we are part of a much bigger universe.
Okay. Now, your book is fascinating. It goes into pre-flood and then flood societies, but a lot of it is based on different parts of the world. Is it your opinion that these ancient, and I'm going to use the term megalithic builders, because they used, in a lot of cases, heavy, heavy, multi-ton stones to build their structures. Would you say that they had an understanding of sacred energy, earthbound energy, that we just don't appreciate today?
Oh, totally. I mean, you look at this stuff, and for example, if you go to Sacsayhuaman in South America, or you go to some of the interior chambers of the pyramids in Egypt, and Stonehenge, and you look at this and you think, either the people who built this were extremely tall, because then it would make sense, because to them these things would be no more than bricks to us, or they had complete control and were totally comfortable with moving extraordinarily large objects. I mean, Baalbek is one great example. I mean, why use a small brick when you can move a 13-ton, 1,000-ton stone? It's almost like they were taking the mic. So they were obviously comfortable with size, and explaining the fact that you can move these things on rollers will not cut it, because when you look at some of the wood that's available in these areas, the pulp inside the wood is too wet to be able to hold the weight of some of these stones, so we can rule that out. But the one thing I really enjoyed was going back through time, reading different myths from different cultures who allegedly had no contact with each other, and all of them, without exception, start talking about the temples were built overnight, and they used vocal commands or sounds of some unusual kind, and the stones levitated through the air. And I thought, well, people back then, if we accept the orthodox view that they were stupid and totally idiotic and just lived off the land from one day to the next, they obviously would not have the imagination to come up with such nonsense. So obviously they must have been writing from either memory or from observation. And when you start putting these things together, they do stack up. Now, here's where it comes back to the modern era. You got to dig under a lot of stones to suddenly find the science behind all of this, because what I like to do is take the supposition and then throw science and try and ground it with some real fact.
Right.
So I actually found an experiment that was done at Princeton about 20 years ago by a group of people who actually were doing exactly what I do now, which is to try and balance the science and mysticism. And they looked at these theories and they said, well, what if it's true? If the certain type of stone that is used to build the sacred sites, and the stone does get moved from a long, long way away from the point of origin, look at the stone and look at the type of quartz that's in the stone, because it's a particular type of quartz. And what Princeton did is they took this quartz and they put it in the container, and they began to experiment with sound frequency. And lo and behold, they hit one frequency and the stone levitates. It's a small one,
about the size
of your small finger. And I believe, I don't know if the site is still up, it's called PEAR. It's the acronym for the actual group. It may still be up. The group was closed down a few years ago for lack of funding. But it did the most extraordinary experiments, not just on that, but also the implementation of human consciousness on everyday objects. And that's what really cemented the whole theory for me, because, yes, these people were able to use sound to basically move objects which really are nothing more than a bunch of atoms vibrating around electrons at very fast speed. So you figure out the right frequency, you can basically start playing with anti-gravity.
Well, that would be a known physics if they use sound. I've always been curious that some of these megaliths are so massive, it's like it's a physics we don't know about. But what you're talking about is possibly just an area of science that we haven't touched upon yet. We just haven't got to that point to understand the components of an object and how it can be moved through the vibration of sound, which is a whole different, I guess it's a whole different science. It's coming, kind of up and coming is what you're suggesting.
It's really down to the nuts and bones of what matter is all about. It's just a bunch of atoms moving in high vibration, giving the illusion that the chair that I'm sitting on or the computer that you're looking at is very real, when in fact it's just a bunch of atoms circulating and enclosing elements of air that, when put together, give the illusion of a physical object to you and I, because we happen to be of the same frequency. Now, you change the frequency, you change the shape of things, and that's something that we're now beginning to accept in modern science. So these people obviously understood things, and I suspect that the answer is much simpler than what we're looking for, because let's accept for a second that they did not have advanced technology, which may or may not be the case, depending on your view of sunken continents and previous civilizations, you know, before which are antediluvian. That's a whole other story altogether. But let's assume for a second that they did not have what we have today, and they literally had more connection with the natural world, which is something we have lost. And I can say, hand on heart, having done this for 20 years, that the more you work with the natural world, the more it talks back to you, and the more you start becoming aware that you are much more powerful than you could possibly imagine. To quote Obi-Wan Kenobi, and it really is, there's a lot of truth in Star Wars, believe me. I think Lucas was channeling stuff, but I think that they basically were able to connect with the natural world, hear it and see it in a very subtle way, and diagnose it and dissect it to the point where they could say, okay, that's how it works. Let's now apply that using the power of our intent, which we now know today to be a very powerful tool. And again, Pear has proved this very well, where in laboratory experiments, a small group of people with focused intent was able to change the computerized drumbeat created by a computer. Now, that is extraordinary. If 23 people can do that to a computer, imagine what a group of people can do to a stone to get it from A to B. So obviously it has something to do with the natural laws, and all you have to do is just pay attention.
Well, you have definitely paid attention. You know, in your book, the book is Divine Blueprint, you describe sacred sites as places of power. What does that mean, places of power?
It's a very loaded term, actually. In fact, it goes from physics to metaphysics. We begin, first of all, with the fact that every sacred site on Earth, without exception, is located at the intersecting lines of the Earth's forces of energy. So electromagnetism, sometimes gravity. All the sacred sites are built on these hot spots. In fact, it even forms the fundamental concept of the Hopi creation myth, which, to cut a long story short, says that when a drummer went to the South Pole and started to imitate the heartbeat of the Earth Mother, the Earth sent out rays of force to the surface, and the Earth becomes abundant with life. And they say that there were some spots along the Earth that were super abundant with this energy, and those were called the spots of the fawn, and that's what native cultures in the Southwest describe as being the essential landscape temples that they go and do their meditations and their other out-of-body journeying. At some point, we began to lose the sight to be able to detect these places with our God-given ability, so we built temples on top of them to remind us of these hot spots. So that's what defines them as places of power. Now, it gets even better than that. We are made of exactly the same material. We are electromagnetic beings. And when you put an electromagnetic human person inside this temple, if you allow yourself just to be still and also to be open to accepting that there, we don't know everything about everything, skeptics, of course, will not believe this, but if you just go in with an open mind and accept the spirit of place for what it is, strange things start happening to you. You start developing a heightened state of awareness. People will have out-of-body experiences, and that's indeed also what these places were used for. They were used for accessing the other world, where people would have control, near-death experiences, to cross a veil of reality, come back with total awareness of what they had seen and where they had been. And many people that we know from fame, like Plato or Pythagoras, experienced this in some of these sacred sites. So it's not just the fact that they are powerful to begin with, because they do anchor special hot spots on the face of the earth. It's the fact that they also can make you a very powerful person and remind you that you are a god, which is exactly what's written in some of the temples in Egypt as well.
Fascinating. You know, you look at ancient man and the many, many power places of power that are around the world. But would you say that we, in our modern world, possess places of power that that we don't really know are places of power? As an example, there may be, and you describe various natural formations. You give an example out here in Northern California, Mount Tamalpais, having some geomagnetic magnetic properties in seats and stones and things that when you sit, you actually can go into an altered state of consciousness. Those are kind of known and may have been known for thousands of years, but would you say there are any modern equivalents to places of power, or are these mostly of an ancient nature?
Well, the ones that I can readily put my finger on, of course, are the Gothic cathedrals, and these were built on top of the original sacred sites, as many Catholic buildings were in Europe. But the Gothic cathedrals are different insofar as they were originally created by the Cistercian monks, who were basically the creators of the Knights Templar. And the inner group of the Templars, all, when they were in the Middle East, they learned from these mystical people about the knowledge of manipulating energy. And this is one of the reasons why they were sought after. They were loved and hated by the Orthodox in equal amounts. They literally let the cat out of the bag. So they, knowing that the time was kind of coming up and they weren't going to fight the church, and they really didn't have the resources to fight both the church and the combined forces of the King of France, they would be crazy to think that they did. So knowing that at some point the knowledge that they had gained and they were sharing with people, with the local populations, would be lost, they hardwired the information into the Gothic cathedrals. It's one of history's greatest jokes that the Catholic Church allowed these buildings to be put where they were as a monument to God. But it wasn't their God. It was the Templars' God, which is the God of everyone. It's something that is shared and self-empowering. So when you get to a Gothic cathedral, you do get a sense that there is another worldly atmosphere in there. You just forget about all the regalia that's been added to it over the years. You know, the gold statues and the windows. Those were never part of the original plan. They're just very, very plain buildings. And I was looking at what the Russians were doing with regard to Gothic cathedrals, because they were looking into these legends as well, that there were unusual things about these buildings. And they said, you know, we're hard up for money, and this was back in the 60s, we're hard up for money. What if it's true that they say that if you build a building in a special site and you do a certain geometry called sacred geometry, and you shape the building so, and then you also look at the fact that these buildings were sonic environments, I mean, they're acoustically tuned environments, and people were getting healed and also having out-of-body experiences. What if it's true? Well, you know what? They actually built these things, small replicas of these buildings in Bulgaria in the 60s and the 70s, and they measured the effects on people, and it's extraordinary what they wrote. They said that, you know, when you build a building shaped like a pentagram, which is a symbol of healing in mythology, people's rate of healing actually goes up dramatically. And when you even you can even treat people with schizophrenia by putting them in shapes which are like trapezoids. So they obviously were able to validate the fact that the buildings, these medieval sacred sites, literally do have a profound effect on you, even in the modern era. So, and this is what, one of the reasons why we love going to these places. You may not be aware of it, but it does have a profound effect on you, and that's why they built these things big and also to last, because they realized at some point in our culture we would lose the plot and we would need to find a place to go to reconnect with it.
It's fascinating. Your book is just, it blows my mind for the simple reason that you begin to educate us, and I mean that, you actually educated me on understanding the natural foundations of our planet and how important they are and how the ancients knew about these sacred places. And you talk about sacred mountains, and something that I didn't understand is that a lot of these mountains around the world have, because they're made of crystalline rock and things like that, they possess an energetics that those of us who and the ancients obviously were very sensitive to the emanations of these places, and they built around them. And what's fascinating is you give an example of a natural pyramid, a place in Egypt called Dihenet, which oversees the Valley of the Kings, and is also shows it's close to the Giza Plateau where there's pyramid. I mean, how did they understand the linkage and to put all that together? I mean, it's obviously creating some kind of vibration that they were sensitive to, but to build basically a complex of pyramids based on the sighting of this mountain is just fascinating.
It is, and it goes back to what I was saying about the ancients being much more close to nature than we are. It literally is that simple. We are very sensitive beings, but because we tend to put intellect first, we tend to begin to, you know, shut away all those things that really make life work and really serve us very well. And the ancestors were very much aware of that, and they took that. And you know, they weren't obviously immune to catastrophes, but they knew they were going to be happening, and that they would prepare for them. And they knew that some people wouldn't make it and some would, but that's the way life is, and they accepted it. And so it's not really unusual to find indigenous cultures who were very sensitive to the environment, who would then go to a place like Dehenet in Egypt and say, well, this is a very special spot. We feel that what we call the tingly winglies, very technical term.
Right.
we feel the tingly winglies here. And, and if you put yourself again in a state of meditation, you can have these altered states without even drinking ayahuasca. It's a very natural way of literally having an out-of-body experience. So they reasoned that one of the ways to find out what we're doing here and what our purpose in life is and how can we make our lives a little bit better is to have an out-of-body experience and come back with the information to make it so. So one thing leads to another, and eventually they began to obviously place their deceased pharaohs around the base of this this pyramidal mountain. And it literally is, the top literally is a pyramid. And
yeah,
it's from
seen
there
it.
That they
fascinating.
Said, yeah. Yeah. It's really incredible. And there is a temple at the top dedicated to the god of wisdom, by the way. So they took this and they said, well, let's then just shape the pyramids after this mountain, because the pyramidal shape itself is also has all kinds of certain energetic properties to go with it, which is why every pyramid feels completely different, because the slopes, each slope angle is ever so slightly different, and that creates an internal pressure on the on the visitor that goes inside. So it literally was a matter of just distilling the natural processes and applying them on a human level. It's quite extraordinary thinking.
You actually describe what I think you used the word original stone, which was kind of a stone, a raw natural stone that a lot of not only cathedrals were built on, but we know now that in the base of the Great Pyramid, there's the original stone that – we're not sure if water was pumped in there or not, but was was built on top of. Now, I don't know, and maybe you know, and maybe some other researchers know, if the Great Pyramid is built over a massive geomagnetic telluric field that pulses
up.
Oh, it
up. Is.
Is it?
Oh, it is.
Oh, okay.
I've
but that's
that.
Interesting it's... that they would find and be able to detect. And this happens at in Peru, too. I know at... Cusco, there's areas, there's buildings that are built on top of much, much earlier what appears to be volcanic rock, but it's probably the original stone that they sense was the point of eruption or point of emanation. It's just amazing. It's just amazing that they had the ability to understand that, and we just seem to have lost that ability.
I know, it's pretty sad, isn't it? And this is one of the reasons why I really wanted to get that book done and why it took so long to research. It was really trying to figure out what was the idea behind this. I mean, they could have if these were just astrological markers, and a lot of them are, obviously. In fact, they fulfill many, many different functions in one site. This is why there's so much argument as to why, you know, these places were used for healing and they were used for meditation, they were used for sacrifices. Well, actually, they weren't used for sacrifices at all. But they fulfilled many, many functions for the purpose of the tribe. And you figured it would be easier just to build with trees, stumps, or you know small stones, but no, they felt necessary to build this to last, and it seems to have lasted into our lifetime for a good reason. And that's where the big aha really came in, because when you start looking at the surviving texts from southern India, and certainly the temples in Egypt, which are very clear about the function of the temple and what it does and who built it, it was quite clear that these people could see ahead of time, and they could see the ages of mankind, that we would go through certain changes, and there would be one point where we would lose the plot, and we would need to get back to square one, to reconnect with our environment. And yes, it does sound very New Agey, but you know what? It really is the solution to so many of our problems. We have to basically work with the nucleus of the environment that gave birth to us, which is the Earth. If we forget that nucleus, we are in deep trouble. I mean, we're already in deep trouble just by having so much of our information on cell phones, for example, or smartphones, which are actually, ironically, making a lot of people very stupid. Remember the time, Cliff, when you and I could remember all the phone numbers in your diary off the top of your head?
Anyway. Yeah.
It was a long time ago.
It was.
And today, I can't even remember one number. I can't even remember my own number. And I think it was for this reason that they built this insurance policy. And so when you start, when you start dismembering the sites and trying to figure out how they're built, what's encoded in them, you realize that each one has a library of information, and it really is very, very self-empowering to know this.
Is it your opinion that the antediluvial people were of a higher intelligence, or is it more that they had a closer connection to Earth, and in that connection were provided with the information by whatever sources to tap the natural emanations of the Earth to become these beings that were clairvoyant and had things that we consider psychic abilities? I mean, my question is basically, it seems like there was a different kind of a human being on the face of the Earth at the time of these, I call them the megalithic builders. What do you say about that?
I totally agree. In fact, I'm working on a small project which has been consuming me for a decade, mostly because it's so hard to prove. And it's all so simple just to put out an opinion, but I don't want to put out an opinion. I want to put out actual proof. And I'm becoming pretty certain after all the work I have done in different parts of the world that something happened here in 9703 BC, and I'm very certain of this date because it's a geological ice core sample that was done by Danish geologists about 10 years ago. Which conclusively proves that exactly on that date, and carbon dating can be off by 100 years here and there when you start talking 11,000 year span, but they're pretty certain that given the current methodology, 9703 BC, we were hit by the disintegrating fragments of a large comet, and it happens periodically as well. And before this, the surviving texts do talk about a time of creator gods. There were people who were not only large mentally, but also physically, and they had complete control of the laws of nature. They understood things that we don't. And the survivors of this incredible cataclysm were then called the Builder Gods. It was their charge to rebuild, and I quote, the former mansions of the gods, to really kickstart civilization. And at that moment, we have agriculture appearing, but we also begin to see all the oldest sacred sites on the face of the earth are all around coastlines. And I'm beginning to suspect that given the myths and given the evidence that survives, that there were groups of humanoids. And there's some debate about whether they were alien or whether they were actually different humans. I want to go with the human side. I think we're actually quite smart people to do things
yes.
by ourselves.
Yes.
And I just think that these people were smart enough to understand that they formed a society apart from early Homo sapiens and also the Neanderthals, who basically were quite immature at that point. So 10,000, 12,000 years ago, we have groups of very enlightened people who are very tall, with unusual-looking skulls in some point, which we have discovered in Britain and also in Northern Europe, in places called Giant's Graves, which still exist. And it was only because of the flood and the fact that their homeland sank under huge waves, and all the myths talk about this. There's 124 myths around the world that describe exactly the same event. And these builder gods of enormous stature then moved to the continents, to the mainland, and began to rebuild their former mansions of the gods, which we today call the historical temples. And that's when the overlap begins with humanity, and that's when we, as lowly human beings, begin to develop animal husbandry, agriculture, writing, and et cetera. And I think there's something to that. I just have to finally prove it with a little bit more sort of meat on the bone.
I mean, Graham just came out with his latest book, Magicians of the Gone, Graham Hancock. And in it, he described younger Dryas' devastation in the first third of the book. He goes into great detail about it. And it was a devastating event that pretty much wiped the surface of the planet clean of most animal life and civilization. And what you're saying, I think he talks about it too, is these beings who came forth. You call them builder gods, and these would be the survivors of these advanced civilizations, be it Atlantis or other places around the world that had. I mean, there's legends and there's different theories about Atlantis having outposts, and that the Yucatan Peninsula was a harbor for a lot of Atlantean individuals. And this is, you know, the funny thing about it is I think our history is just plain screwed up because they say the Mayans are a recent, you know, a group of people. But if you go to the Yucatan Peninsula, you can see examples of Greek temples, much smaller. You can see architectural styles that are almost from Mediterranean in different areas. And even though it's not purely Greek or a lost civilization, it's definitely unique enough to make you think. So there is a lot of evidence for a much, much earlier civilization. And so when you say the builder gods came, that would be from one of these advanced civilizations. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And the Egyptians called them the builder gods. There are different names for them depending on where you are in the world. But the Egyptian texts are so intact, and also the ones in southern India are also very intact. They talked about the people that basically escaped these cities of knowledge that were violated by transgressions of the ocean. That's how they actually phrase it. And they also describe these people as being like giants, metaphorically and possibly physically. We have in the Celtic lands the Tuatha De Danann, the people of the goddess Anna, who suddenly came across Ireland and the western coasts of Europe on unusual boats, and they brought with them the knowledge of the stars, writing, the arts, all the civilizing influences. We have the builder gods in South America, in Tiwanaku, that suddenly show up, you know, with Viracocha and his seven shining ones. The concept of this builder god being followed by seven buddies called the Seven Shining Ones also happens in many cases around the world. It happens in Mesopotamia. And I'm also beginning to discover somewhere in the Pacific Islands as well, there's also the same story, Easter Island as well. In fact, I'm almost paraphrasing Graham's work, but our work has overlapped on so many levels for so many years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we talked about this. It's just, you know, we're borrowing from the same source. So, yes, the thing I'm trying to ascertain is, were they, all of these people really on islands? Because it seems to me quite clear that these people were not only a society apart, they also look different, but they also maintain their distance from the continents. That's the hard part to prove. We know Atlantis was definitely in the Atlantic. I mean, you just look at the early Mayan myths, and they called it the Atlan. So that's where the name comes from. Plato has now been proved to have been only 100 years off from the 9,700 BC cataclysm. He claims that Atlantis sunk in 9,600. So he's right on the mark, really. I mean, it's 100 years in 11,000 years is really not that much off. But it also broke up in three different time periods, which, again, seems to link to the rise and fall of the Ice Ages. And again, if you look at just the Pacific, where I've just come from, there's an awful lot of landmass missing there. And you talk about the myths of Easter Island. Well, you bring the sea level down 120 feet from where it was 12,000 years ago, and you've got a much bigger landmass in the middle of the Pacific, and you have people moving there. In fact, I was just in New Zealand reading the history and the myths of the Waitaha, who were the native culture of New Zealand way before the Maori, and they talk about a huge catastrophe that forced them off Easter Island. And in fact, when they went back a long time later, they were distraught to find that the landmass, you know, was totally devastated by massive waves. They found huge trees there that they said, and I quote, were not native to the land. You know, so they obviously must have flowed from a long, long way away, because the biggest trees that you'll find to that description are in California, and that's what, 2,000, 3,000 miles away from Easter Island, if I'm not mistaken. So they obviously have memory of that cataclysm as well. So these people definitely were living on separate lives and separate lands, and I like the idea, because look at what will happen in about 20 years ago when a group of anthropologists went on a hike to New Guinea. They accidentally stumbled upon a tribe that they didn't know they existed. And this tribe was walking around naked. They were minding their own business. And suddenly they found these gods coming out of the bushes, dressed with unusual round things strapped to their wrists. And they were talking to some little red box to their ear, you know. And they had a third eye, which they moved with their fingers. Mm-hmm. And the anthropologists were both amazed and distraught, because they realized, because of their supposed and alleged superiority or advanced culture, they inadvertently ruined that culture. And they went away. They went back quietly a year later and spied on this society to see what impact, if any, they had done. And they have found, to their chagrin, that yes, by their interaction, they had completely altered the social structure of that group. For good reason and for bad reasons too. I mean, they suddenly realized that there was a hierarchy, and the big man sitting on a throne with a banana leaf wrapped to his wrist, that would declare him as a god, because he was imitating and dressed like the gods that came from the woods. So you see how suddenly, by interacting with a lesser developed species, you begin to either usually it doesn't bode well for the other species. Historically speaking, so you would want to stay a society apart, and living on an island would certainly fulfill that criteria.
That's interesting. You know, you describe a number of amazing ancient ruins, and one of the ones I want to talk about is the oldest known ruin in South America, Tiwanaku in Bolivia. And I want to ask you this, and you obviously have researched this area quite thoroughly. When Poznanski dated it at 17,000 years old, based on its astrological or astronomical alignment and some other characteristics, at the time he gave that date, the local scientists basically accepted it. And then we come forward to today, and now he's been disregarded and basically,
that's unusual.
It's just that he's not considered a valid scientist anymore after spending, I don't know, two decades in the location. And there's a lot of really, really amazing anomalies, pure, straightforward anomalies in this location. Megaton slabs of carved stone. The fact that it's has a pyramid on the structure. John Burke has tested the area and found that a lot of the area is built on telluric fields, and that a lot of the buildings ran energy, which makes one think about potentially having power sources to do things. You know, just to have an open mind about it makes you say that, hey, this is a really sophisticated area. Why do you think Poznanski is disregarded in that manner?
Oh, it's quite simple. Archaeology and history are very highly conservative environments. And if you look at it from their point of view, yes, you can see that when alternative people come up with an alternative view, it creates a knee-jerk reaction in the establishment. They like to hold on to their pet theories. and accepted truths, despite the fact that when you start poking holes in the theories with new information, they don't hold up to scrutiny. And so they invent this word called pseudoscience to discredit anyone that's not part of the inner group of those conservative elements. The fact is that science is about the art of discovering the new and having an open mind to be molded enough and to be pliable enough to accept new findings, to expand your theory and reject it if necessary. And that's called letting go of the ego. Very hard to do. And unfortunately, they've stuck themselves to this situation where they would hold on to theories, knowing full well that they will not stand the test of time. And rather than accepting new ideas, they just decided to basically pull down the people with them. And that's what's happened to Poznanski. And, you know, and Graham Hancock gets a lot of that as well, obviously. I do as well to a certain degree. Thank God he's around. He deflects most of it from everybody else. I'll have to buy him a drink one day.
For everybody. I mean,
absolutely.
I've gotten my licks. I've had people give licks into me too. So, but what is it about Tiwanaku that you found was unique? I found it unique, and I've known about it for probably 20, 30 years because I read about it when I was younger, and how at one time it was close to a lake. And I remember, I think even Eric Von Däniken, which I don't really go into his theories, but he felt that the earth had shifted and the tectonic plates had moved and whatever.
I think he's actually not that far off with regard to Tiwanaku, because when you start looking at the combined geology and the archaeology of the area, and this is where the point of contention comes, because in order to shoehorn, in fact, deliberately to shoehorn the age of Tiwanaku into the accepted Christian and European view of things, the archaeology and the carbon dating is done from the top layers, which gives you, an accepted date of about, 1000 BC at the most. Yes, there were people there 1000 BC, but that's the last time they were there. Then you've got other layers on top of that of local habitation, and then it all goes very sterile. But if you go down another 12 to 20 feet of sterile soil, and then you come up to some very unusual things, and that's where the problems begin, because when you start dating the soil 20 feet down below the accepted level of trench digging, you start discovering the fact that the earth was hit by something so big that it literally emptied Lake Titicaca all through the site. And that's when you find human bones with seashells, the bones of fish, which are no longer alive, that come from a prehistoric era, and also shards of what looked like pottery all jumbled together. And that's way, way below the accepted layer of carbon dating. So now that's, and of course that begins to validate Poznanski's work, but also it begins to bring several things close together. One, that Poznanski was well aware of archaeoastronomy, that the fact that the ancestors always aligned their temples to the stars. So by aligning the corner of the main courtyard of Kala Sasaya, which is the courtyard of the standing stones, which today is actually it is a formal courtyard, but the courtyard was not there. It was just literally a rectangle of very large megaliths, and most of those are still there. The infill has come from recent eras. When you align the back end to the spring equinox, as one is supposed to do, he goes back and says, okay, what about the precession of the equinoxes? Because if this thing is so old, you should be able to retrograde the stars to the horizon, and lo and behold, bingo, each one of those pillars does mark a star on the horizon at 15,000 BC. A few years ago, it was recalibrated to about 14,000, but he's not that far off. It was obviously, we have more specialist technology that we can get more precise dates. And then come the myths after that. You have this enormous catastrophe in 9,703 BC, and suddenly you go down to this 20-foot deep trench. You go for the carbon dating, and you find all of this mess created by this rampaging tsunami that hit the site, and then the place goes very quiet. So, and then of course they're built after that as well, because my recent research on Tiwanaku, which I haven't actually published, shows quite clearly that there were three building periods, and you can tell by the actual design of the stones themselves. just like when you can at Sacsayhuaman. Waman. If you look carefully, there are three building periods, always megalithic, but the elements of the new temples are misaligned by 4 degrees, and this temple was aligned to the equinox, and they were never off by 1 degree, let alone 4. So it tells me that that place was, the earth was hit by something quite huge, and it really shook the Andes. And the new people that survived and built on top of that removed the temples on top of the old sites by 4 degrees, which is where we are today.
Oh.
It's extraordinary stuff. I mean, but again, you've got to look at it from a multidimensional point of view. You've got to bring archaeology, you've got to bring geology, geometry, precession, and only then do you get an idea of what really is happening. And even then, it's a close approximation to the truth.
You know, it's funny, when I read about author, for our audience, author Poznanski was born in Vienna, Austria, in 1873, and he was an engineer, he was a ship's navigator, and he was kind of a avocational archaeologist. He wasn't considered an archaeologist, but he was a very bright man and spent a tremendous amount of time, was a prolific writer on this area of South America, and he convinced the science of the day that this was a significant place, and a number of people, including yourself, have written about his work, but for his research to be downplayed now is just kind of it's unfortunate, I think, because
it's very silly.
It
really is very silly. And in fact, the people of the day, the scientists of the day, actually did look at his work, and they, you know, mathematics is mathematics. It's either right or wrong. There's no middle ground. Mm-hmm. And they checked his work, and they said, absolutely, the math checks out. But you had this conservative backlash. They cannot accept the old European medieval, whatever you want to call it, mindset, Victorian mindset. Mm-hmm. They're within that sort of... I mean, you've got to understand that these people don't have, there are not many paid jobs in these fields. People have to rely on tenures at colleges. So if they are looked as if they were posing a theory that was actually, did not have much of a foundation, they obviously are fearful for their jobs. And I understand that. But at the same time, all you have to do is say, well, yes, the theory was good up to this point, but now, look, we have new information. We can now expand the theory. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to take people down for their good work. I mean, that's usually, for me, a sign that people have completely lost the argument when you start getting personal, you know.
Keep
the facts, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. You have some excellent observations, and I want to talk about Chapter 8, Kingdom of Conscience. And you have a section called Conscience, excuse me. Raising of Conscience, I'm sorry. Kingdom of
Conscience is a whole new book. In fact, I think you've just given me a whole new idea for a new book about conscience.
But anyhow,
thanks, Cliff.
Okay.
I'll give you credit.
All right. We'll have to have you back on the show for that new book. But there's a subsection called The Raising of Great Stones. And in it, you describe, and this is just, it was a fascinating, this is the only excerpt I've ever read from this about something like this. And you kind of prefaced it in the beginning of the program. You believe that. Techniques were developed, and you talked about it, where sound and certain sciences were combined to raise megalithic stones into place. And some people have talked about it, but in this case, a Swedish doctor named Jarl witnessed the lifting of massive boulders 700 feet up into a Tibetan temple, I guess, by monks using, you describe them as musical instruments.
Yeah,
and this Dr. Jarl was so fascinated by this that he took films. He recorded these actions in films, and he showed it to the English Society. Now, rather than revealing this to the world, the English Society confiscated those films. Why the hell did they do that? That would solve the problem for so many of these histories. I mean, that's just a fantastic piece of possibility that we have lost.
Yeah, for the same reason that I noted earlier, and also for the same reason that the British Museum and the Smithsonian are guilty, and this is on record, of stealing the bones of giant people buried in mounds in both mm-hmm. countries and hoarding them away until they can find an acceptable way to explain them, because in the current paradigm, they did not fit the paradigm. For the same reason that I believe it was the, and now I hope they don't come knocking on my door, the FBI or the CIA stole most of the gizmos from the Coral Castle in Florida after a small little man called Edward Leedskillen, who's about 5 foot one, using sound and a lot of copper wire and sound generators, was seen moving large blocks of coral without the aid of any other paraphernalia. So that's the reason why it's so hard to try and figure out his methodology, is because so much of that stuff, and this is on record, by the way, it's not an opinion, there was a federal agency that went around and took a lot of the stuff away. So it's incomplete what you see in Coral Castle today. But good old Edward, and I believe someone's written a good book on this. I can't put my finger on it right now, because he kept talking about this. I did this for my sweet 16. And people keep thinking that, oh, it's to do for a sweetheart that he lost. Well, if you know anything about the mystery secrets, you will know that people like this always talk in riddles, especially metaphors. And there's a gentleman, and I wish I could tell you the name on air because I can't. I just don't remember. But it's something to do with Sweet 16, and this gentleman obviously knows the mysteries and how they work. And he said, well, that's a metaphor. It's to do with mathematics. And if you understand what the Sweet 16 is, you follow what Leedskillen wrote, that it was all to do with the fact that humans and conventional science still does not understand how gravity works. And that's the big key. He found out a way to work with vibration, which is what sound is, to manipulate gravity. So we're back to a modern guy at the turn of the century rediscovering this very ancient science. So, and you know, and there's your the reason. This is why it makes the establishment so uncomfortable. You can't fit it into the conventional paradigm. There is also, of course, the additional theory now in the modern era that, of course, a lot of these things are weaponized. If you can use sound to basically weaponize your military and do the opposite, which is to destroy things with sound, which we know we can do because that's also on record, sound is a great ability to create and destroy. If you can weaponize that, then obviously, well, you don't have to build very expensive gizmos to go off and destroy your enemy. So this is another reason why certain people have a certain vested interest in making sure this doesn't really come out. It's really that simple. It's human nature.
It's just fascinating, though, because, Jarl was, this is a this filming of this lifting of stone with sound was like 1930s, which means that whatever film we're talking about was very rudimentary, probably no sound at all, but at least we could see these, who knows how big these boulders were, lifted into the
about
air.
About the size of a large chest of drawers. He actually made a drawing of it, which survived.
Oh, he did.
And I have seen it. And they arranged these trumpets and drums in two semicircles with a specific angle to them. And
illustrated the event, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. And he also measured the distance between drums and the boulder and showed the actual trajectory of the boulder. And and again, this guy was a doctor. I mean, doctor of medicine. He was basically, and back then, there was a much more conscientious society where people were very mindful of their position in society. They did not wish to be associated with any subject that would ridicule them, even much more so than today. Not because they're afraid of being sued, but because they were afraid of losing their position in society. So if you look at the time period that we're involved in, here's a guy that sticks his neck out to talk about a really out there subject, and he puts his whole position on the line to bring this information out. So I don't think that he was making this up, because back then you would not want to lose your 10 years as a doctor in London. This would be the worst possible thing you could do. You go back to being, part of the working class, which back then was not much fun. So, he filmed it. He made the diagrams. He wrote about it extensively. So I can say, hand on heart, that I totally believe the story. But the Tibetans, a lot of people have gone to Tibet and have also talked about the same thing, how they experienced it with this monks traveling almost through the air at speed, as though they were defying gravity. They could move through the air. You read this stuff and things that the yogis and the rishis were capable of doing. In fact, I was just reading a book by Paul Brunton, who is also from the same period, talking about the secret India and how he too was witnessing some of these events and unusual things done by ordinary people who literally had mastered the laws of physics.
Let's talk about Paul Brunton. He is highlighted in your book in an area that, well, this is why you're on the program right now, because you talk about...
You revealed the secret now. I'm in big trouble now.
We want to hear it from Freddie Silva. We want him to give us the secrets to immortality and raising above and flying without having to propel ourselves with a carbon-based creation. But anyhow, in this chapter, you wrote about this. I guess he's a traveler, somebody who was an explorer. Who decided that he was tired of conventional life, and he started traveling the world and chronicled his explorations. And what was unique is he has a passage where he wanted to stay inside the Great Pyramid of Giza, and he got, I guess he paid somebody to get a chance to go in.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was in there, he had quite an experience. Why don't you tell us what he experienced with the lights?
Yes, I did. He did. I love Paul Brunton's work. Here's a guy in the 30s and the 20s who was, get this, he was disgruntled with modern life. He was a reporter, and he basically went walkabout, and he figured there's got to be something more to life than this. And he went in searching of truth, wisdom, knowledge, with an open mind. His books are fascinating. This particular account was stunning, and I think I know where this is leading, by the way, Cliff. I'm going to preempt this by saying that before I actually had a similar experience, I had not read his book. So I'm just going to say that for now.
I was going to ask you that, so go ahead.
Oh, okay. See, this is what happens when you do this stuff. You become kind of clairvoyant.
Yeah.
So Paul was able to have the ability to spend the whole night in the Great Pyramid. He had no idea what he's going to get himself into. He had no sort of agenda, which again is a great way of framing this argument, because some things you can be psychosemantic. You can create things because you so want to believe something. That was not him. He's always stated that, which makes his work so authentic and so original. So he goes into the Great Pyramid without any subterfuge, and he spends the night in there. He goes into the king's chamber with his little light, and the light goes out. And the next thing he sees is all of these figures dressed in what can only be described as this glowing white satin, very tall figures, coming out of the stones and literally talking to him and telling him that, are you sure you really want to do this? And because, you know, once you do this, your life is going to be very difficult. Your path on the physical world will be very difficult for you. Mm-hmm. You will be seen as being very different. You will not fit in. And he said, without even blinking, absolutely, I'm ready for this. And they basically took him walkabout for all the secret chambers inside the Great Pyramid. And there's a lot of them. And he wasn't permitted to go into some of them because they said, you're not really ready for this. It's not appropriate for humanity to know this at this stage in life. They have to basically develop a bit more maturity before they understand other more important facets of life. And he describes them as though he was standing. These people were standing right next to him. And he's not the first person either. I mean, we heard the story of Napoleon, how he spent the night in the pyramid as well. And he left in the morning. Well, they locked the door. They locked him in there. And they opened the door in the morning. He ran out like a banshee, as though something he had seen in the king's chamber frightened the hell out of him. And he forbade anyone to ask him what he had seen right up to his deathbed. And his best friend, sensing that Napoleon was about to tell him on his last breath what he saw in the Great Pyramid, and Napoleon draws him closer to him and says, I'll tell you. And then he just says, oh, what's the point? You'll never believe me. And he dies. I also have a friend of mine who works with, ironically, with sound. He's a sound engineer, one of the best people in the field, called John Reed. And he even builds sound devices to show how powder turns into living geometry. Extraordinary guy. He's a very sort of left-brain guy who has a wonderful intuitive side to him, which he rarely admits. But he also describes the sense of being watched inside the King's Chamber whenever he does his scientific experiments in there, like there are unusual luminous beings that suddenly come out of the stone and surround him. So there's been quite a few people that have actually experienced this. It's quite dramatic.
But Freddie, I think we need to come clean here. You actually had your own experience inside the pyramid, right? You actually...
Yes, I did.
And you had a similar experience.
Identical. In fact, this is why I was saying that I did not read Paul's work, and thank God, because it really helped validate my experience. And I, too, had not gone into the Great Pyramid to have an experience. I work with a small group of people in Britain who go about, how shall I say, doing spiritual terrorism. We clean up the mess that other people leave behind at sacred sites. These sites are very sensitive. They are built on electromagnetic principles. And because the stones are filled with quartz, any quartz under pressure remembers stuff. This is why we use the same concept in computers today. They literally are very ancient computers. They will remember good things and bad things. And sometimes when bad things happen in sacred sites, the site remembers and the energy gets very negative. We go around cleaning up the sites. Anyway, we went to Egypt, and I was still learning my craft back then. I was still pretty much sort of half a moron, and not the intellectual giant that I am today, I hope. And so I went with a small group of people up into the King's Chamber. And there was about 12 of us. Half of them didn't feel good in there. They left right away. Each building has its own particular sense of feeling. Some people either like it or they don't. And four of us felt great. And anyone that's been in the Great Pyramid knows that it's impossible to get any quiet time in there unless you pay people a lot of money. We hadn't. We had not managed to get any permission. We had to go in there with the hundreds of other tourists. But you know what? We got to the King's Chamber, and everybody left. Now, nobody does that in the Great Pyramid. The whole place was empty. There was not a sound. And we thought, well, let's take an opportunity while we have it to do a bit of the work that we do, do a bit of quiet meditation, and do the things that we do. And the lights went out, and we're in complete darkness. We can't see a thing. And we began to tone, which for anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's basically using the power of the voice to carry a thought or an intent into a place. And when four people do this, it's very powerful. And we began to tone and the chant inside this room, and literally within seconds, and remember, this is pure darkness. There's not a light to be seen. I am seeing about 32 people dressed in white satin, about, I want to say, about 8 feet tall, 9 feet tall, surrounding us in a circle. And my head is moving around in total darkness looking at this while I'm chanting. And the only thing that I can think of at the time, and I remember this so clearly, is I hope these three other people can see what I'm seeing. Because
well, I was just going to ask you, did they see the same thing?
Well, the lights went on 20 minutes later. There's a very angry Arab person at the bottom of the shaft going, and I'm going, I think we've outstayed our welcome. Let's take 5 minutes each into the sarcophagus just to get a sense of it. And I tell you, that's a whole other story. 5 minutes in the sarcophagus and you're away with the fairies. You come back as if you've been away for 100 years. But we went back downstairs. And we're back into the light. And, you know, it's four guys. And it's quite clear that one of us wants to say something, but we're too guy to actually own up to what we've experienced. So, you know, being the more adventurous one, I said, okay, I'll go first. Did anybody see what I saw in there? And all of them said, oh, there's all these people. They came out of the stones, and they were dressed in this white sort of satin thing, and they were very, very tall. And we all got very excited, and suddenly we just shut up, and we went, my God, we actually did experience this. And here's the best part. The leader of our group, who's a very renowned trans medium in Britain, who actually works with the police force to locate missing people and all kinds of crime, she had been with the rest of the group outside the pyramid, and they were doing their own thing. They had plenty of time on their hands, and they began to actually tune in to the Great Pyramid to us to see what we are up to in the King's Chamber. Now, that's the power of being able to see through things. And we hadn't told this group about what we had seen and what we had experienced. And we came into the bus, and our leader was there, and she says, "So did you have a good time in there?" And before I could even say it, she described everything that we had seen, the people, and the experience of them coming out of the stone. And I said, "How is that possible?" And she said, "Well, it's quite simple. When you become an integral part of the temple, in other words, if your intent and your purpose is true and aligned with the origin of the temple, and you honor the temple in the way it's supposed to be, which you did with your voice, then the spirit of place replies in kind. So obviously they're giving you information for a later time, possibly a book that you'll be writing some years from now." And she couldn't have been closer to the truth, I tell you. And it did change my life. It really did. And it just shows you the power of ancient sacred places and why they're so important. And by the way, anyone can do this. Anyone can do this. You just have to be open, that's all.
Well, you are very intuitive, my friend, because you're leading to my next question, and we're right up against the time here. You know, with your work and your travels and going to these sacred places, can you tell us how we connect when we go to – what should our intention be when we go to a sacred place to get insight, to really tap in like the ancients did? What has been your experience that is the best way to do that? Because some of us listening may not want to be tapped in. Some of us may want to observe, but others of us, and many, many, many of us are ready for this, would like to tap in and possibly gain insight and gain knowledge and maybe even have some enhancements, you know? Get rid of that anger, get rid of that fear, get rid of whatever, and who knows? I mean, maybe you know about this, but do you have an answer to that?
Oh, I have lots of answers for that, and for 1999, I can tell you. actually, it actually leads into, this will be a subject for another conversation, it actually leads into my latest book, which actually goes straight into that. Without getting caught up into that, yes, the first thing that you should know is that the invisible universe will not impinge on your sovereignty. You can either do this subconsciously or consciously, and you can say, "I really don't want to have an experience, thank you very much. I'm happy with the world as it is." You are a sovereign being and a sovereign soul. You will not be impinged upon. And some places will actually do that by making you feel uncomfortable, and that's their way of saying, "You really ought not to be here until you are at the right frequency." And it's really like trying to match two radio stations together, you know. And when your dial is selected to the right station, then obviously you get the information. And I mean, for my way of doing it, some people do yoga beforehand, they'll do fasting, they'll do meditation. I tend to just go do my planning before I go to a site. I actually set my intent when I'm sitting here at my desk and say, "You know, I really would like to go to Peru and learn something about this, that, or the other, and let that fall where it may." And incredibly, I am drawn to the exact locations and sites that actually will provide me with that information. And then the rest of the 50% of the time is me digging up the science to back up what I've been given. And I usually just go with an open state of mind. I'm just very mindful of my thoughts. I try not to have any. I just try to walk quietly, observe without observing. It's as though you're actually walking in between the physical and the non-physical. You're walking a very fine line between being and not being, if you know what I'm saying. You become very aware of your breathing, of sounds become much clearer. You can smell things with greater clarity. And suddenly you become more aware of things than you normally were. And it literally is that simple. And the more you do it, the more your body acts like blotting paper. You begin to soak up the electromagnetism of the site. And because you are an electromagnetic being, you begin to adapt to the frequency of these sites, and then that's when the magic really begins to happen. And I can tell you quite honestly that if that should happen to you, you can kiss your life as you know it goodbye, because you step into another universe. You will never want to come back to this one. And it does make life very difficult. You really have to be a very thick-skinned being to walk in two worlds. But believe me, the fringe benefits, like watching people coming out of stones in the middle of the dark, are wonderful. And it really validates everything, because then you go on to teach this to other people, and it makes their lives better. And then it has a knock-on effect. And this is how we improve society. And that's the way it was always done. Some people choose to do ayahuasca. Some people choose to do deep meditations. Some people in the old days did near-death experiences, controlled near-death experiences, which is the subject of my new work, to actually go out of the body deliberately for 3 days, sometimes longer, and then come back totally aware of what they've seen. And this is the foundation for many of the seers throughout history, like Plato, Pythagoras, Isaac Newton did it. Da Vinci, I believe, also hinted that he did it too. So there are various techniques and tools. They're all correct, depending on who you are. But the central thing is, go there with an open mind. Expect nothing and be pleasantly surprised.
But also have the intent of having some revelation or some exploration or something coming forth. So you set an intention.
It's the intent of growing. Yeah, the intent of growing for the personal self, but also to do whatever you receive for the greater good of yourself and everyone. It doesn't work the other way around, believe me. If you go there with the intent of becoming a megalomaniac, which some candidates in this election cycle are beginning to discover, you'll find that the doors get barred very quickly.
Fascinating. We're at our final hour. The book is The Divine Blueprint, Temples, Power Places, and the Global Plan to Shape the Human Soul. And my guest today has been Freddie Silva. Freddie, it's been a pleasure. We're definitely going to have you back.
Well, thank you, Cliff. Great pleasure.
Because there's so much that you are telling us that we can't fill in the hour plus that we had here. And you've written a number of books. This book was written in 2012, and you've come up with a few books since then. Where can we learn more about what you're up to? Can you give us your website?
Yeah, invisibletemple.com is where you'll find all of that stuff and a lot more and free stuff and God knows what else. In fact, I have to redesign that site. It's getting pretty big.
Good. Glad to hear it. All right. And can we? Are you going to be in the States at all this coming fall? People can hear you at a lecture. Are you going to be at any conferences?
In fact, I'm going to be speaking in Detroit in about 2 weeks, an awareness conference, and or if you want to call it by its more upmarket name, Detroit.
Okay.
I think it's part of the rebuilding of the city. I actually live in Maine right now. In Portland, Maine. Cold Portland, Maine. And although I don't sound like it, but my tour schedule is also up there. I lead tours to sacred sites all the time. In fact, we've got one wonderful one coming up to Peru in November, which you should be part of. It's going to be great fun.
That sounds like
there's always new stuff coming up. So just check in.
Okay, fantastic. That was Freddie Silva. Freddie, thank you again, and I will definitely be back in touch with you to have you on the program with one of your other fascinating books.
Well, thanks, Cliff. Appreciate it.
Okay. All right, so that's it for today. Remember, we are doing that raffle. The raffle is for the Graham Hancock book, Magicians of the God. We have a new book from the publisher. If you want a chance to get it, send me your name. Send it to cliff@earthancients.com. Pick a number between 1 and 600. Send me your address. Remember, if you send me your number without an address, I cannot send you the book. And I actually don't think you should be qualified. So get the address in there with the number. I'll pick a winner Saturday, March 26th. I'll do it on live on air. And you can get a copy of Magicians of the God, Graham Hancock's new book. Okay. Well, I hope we have a great day. And stay with us for next week. Next week, we are going to have Mark Vidler. He wrote a book with Catherine Young called Sacred Geometry of the Earth, The Ancient Matrix of Monuments and Mountains, which kind of follows a little bit about today, but gets into some really, really heavy stuff that's just been found. So hope you'll join us.